welcome to Conversations in Cannabis. Today we're sitting down with Aaron Nino, COO and co-founder at Nevada-based cannabis company, Camp. This call was recorded over the phone on June 29th, 2023.
I really want to hear, from your perspective, especially as someone who's been in the industry for as long as you have, kind of what initially gave you the drive to want to even be in cannabis in the first place?
Yeah, great question. So probably mid-2000s, I was cultivating in my garage, like most of us that were cultivating during those times. And my grandmother came down with Parkinson's. And she's from the East Coast, so North Carolina girl. And there was no way in heck she was going to do any type of marijuana in her terminology. And I knew from the research that I had been doing for probably 7 years prior that cannabis could help with things like that. Now, in those days, extraction methods were super rudimentary, unless we're talking about, bubble bag hashing and cool stuff like that. But I didn't really know how I could create some sort of product that would help her Parkinson's, relieve the stress of the shakes and those violent movements with the flower if she wasn't going to smoke it. So I started researching isolation and just some stuff that I knew from science class in high school and some rudimentary college courses I had taken. And I started to understand and figure out chemical compounds and how to isolate pretty much CBD from cannabis compounds or cannabis X or cannabis flower. Or cannabis, actually. So what I started to do in my garage was I bought a short path distillation unit and started separating, obviously did it wrong for a few months, and then understood that I needed to distill down to an extract and then separate that extract. So really the long and the short of it is I got into cannabis to kind of just grow weed and hustle. I stayed in cannabis to help my grandmother and create some form of consumption that she didn't know she was smoking marijuana. And what I had created or what I had isolated then was CBD. And when I got her that CBD, it didn't help much at all. 2009, I figured out CBD by itself was pretty useless, but CBD with THC or other cannabinoids did something really cool. And those compounds together took her violent shakes, her Parkinson's that was, rendering her useless. It took that down to no shakes and created this functionality in her life that couldn't be given to her with opioids or, maybe drinking alcohol or whatever she would use to kind of get rid of that pain. And that was the key. And that turned it all on for me. That unlocked everything in my world because nobody was doing that. The things that I was reading or the documents that I was researching, because YouTube just had cartoons in those days, right? YouTube didn't have any of the stuff that you could experience and see today. You didn't know how to extract through YouTube or none of that stuff existed. So I was like, I'm really onto something here. I can take chemical compounds or cannabis compounds, separate those compounds, isolate them, and then get them into some sort of form that can help out Parkinson's. Oh my God, this is amazing. This is medical. This is against pharma. Let's do something really cool here. And that's what kind of turned the rest of my life into, my dream of just helping people and how I can take cannabis and turn this into something that's palatable. It can be used in modern day medicine. It can really help people change their lives. And that's really the juice that drove my engine.
Well, and you definitely have grown your career since that initial drive with your grandmother. It's always nice to hear, people's initial foray into cannabis is honestly one of altruistic means. It's something that, it's personal to you, to helping your grandmother. A lot of people in the industry definitely don't have that background. And so it's good to see when people do, because it really drives that personality into the products that you end up developing. And you kind of drove it home right there. Like, the finding of CBD, the deciding of the isolation, and then figuring out that THC with CBD is what helps your grandmother. But your career has exploded since that point. So, Obviously, you're one of the co-founders of one of the premier brands here in Nevada, Camp. How did you eventually meet the people over at The Source and decide that you wanted to co-found, you know, a licensed brand and really take this into the next level?
Yeah, great question. So pretty much, you know, I had, after I had gone through this thing with my grandmother, I had entered a ton of competitions in California, Las Vegas, Colorado. You know, I didn't know how you take your cannabis knowledge and turn that into, not profitable, but I wanted to get in with the guys that had licenses, specifically in California and Vegas. 2015 is when it happened in Nevada, but I wanted to get in with somebody that had, you know, cultivation capabilities or production capabilities or just scaled capabilities, because doing it in my garage obviously wasn't going to be able to touch too many people. And I wanted to be able to get to more people's lives, find more people that had the same story as me, that were hopeless, that wanted to help a family member and wanted to get these products or any type of cannabis to these people for relief. So what I did was I started entering in these competitions as my college degree, even though I've got a degree from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas in healthcare administration. That doesn't really translate sort of into cannabis. And I didn't know how these guys would say, oh, you've got a degree in healthcare, come over and run my facility. So I figured the fastest path to success would be, let's create products, let's enter into competitions and see what happens. Now, I didn't know if I was going to win, lose, draw, who knew? I just knew this is what I know how to do. I know how to bubble bag hash. I know how to grow. I know how to make solventless products. Rosin was in its infancy. Everybody was on that big butane kick in 08 to like 2013. I knew how to do all of that. But how do I take that and turn that into something where someone says, all right, this is the guy. And it took a while, right? Like the first competition I entered in Las Vegas with a partner of mine, we took first place. And my wife said to me, this is your path. Start doing this, building up this trophy case or this list of awards, and take that to somebody and maybe they'll consider you to consult them or come in on their operation. And I did just that. I won a few competitions in Las Vegas with a butane extract. I won a few flower competitions in California, Kushtok, Chalice Festival. I entered in all these competitions. I took first in most. The one I really wanted was Chalice, which I couldn't compete at that time. I was the little dog in the big pond of hash. And there were so many guys doing it great, but I loved it. That energy, that vibe, it was invigorating to be a part of. Again, hitting those things along the way drove me to innovate and be bigger and want more, want to get in with people that had the ability to scale. I came back to Vegas. At that time, I had about 13 awards under my belt, started pitching myself to companies. Some of those companies bit. I helped them build their production labs, helped them scale up their facilities, and then out I went. They didn't need me. They didn't want me. They didn't care about my innovation. They just wanted the knowledge of how to build extraction facilities. Because at that time, not many people were doing that in 2014, 2015. There's a lot more today, but then there wasn't. I got burnt out on it. My mission was waning on me a little bit. I didn't know if this was really what I should be doing. Just stick to small scale, find people that need help, make RSO, cancer patients, whatever I could do to continue spreading the love, but scaling it kind of was out of my control. I went and met with the guys at The Source. They hired me as a packager. And my wife said, why would you do that? You know, you've got a college degree. Why would you go be a packager, minimum wage? And I said, because if I'm there and I'm in it and they need somebody like me, they're not going to look further than in their own circle. And it worked. The owner of the company opened up a few magazines, Vegas Cannabis Magazine out in Vegas. And I was in them. And initially he had said, hey, is this you? I've got a production facility. Can you help me? And I said, no way. It's not me. No chance. And remember at those times, you know, being in those magazines saying that you grow cannabis and you extract, it was kind of, you didn't do that, right? Guys from my world, they don't put themselves out there. It wasn't popular. It wasn't mainstream. When you put yourself out there like that, you're going to get arrested, or you thought the cops were going to follow you, or, you know, they were going to do what they typically did in the past. That didn't happen. So after a few more months, he tapped into me. He had five magazines on the table. He said, okay, this is you. Come run my production facility. We run CO2. What can you do? Fast forward a little bit. I introduced Solventless to the team. They were running CO2. I said, I got this crazy idea called Solventless. I figured out how to make it into a pen. I think this would be great for us. Nobody in Nevada is doing that. Guys in Colorado are doing it. They can't scale it. I know how to scale it. Let's try. He said, I don't know that I want to do it. Let's keep running CO2. But in the background, you can run your small little bubble bag operation. Let's see what happens. They also had this brand that they had done nothing with. It was just a name. It was called Camp. Had nothing associated with it. Really cool marketing around it. Get in touch with nature. I liked the vibe of it. And I said, hey, you only got one shot in cannabis. You can't take a brand, come out with a product, fail, and then come back and reinvent yourself. It's super difficult to do that. You've got to come out strong, good weed, quality weed, stuff that's gassy, tests pretty high, and you should put Solventless underneath it. And at that time, we didn't have really good flower. It was okay. But I knew that I could do something with the live, because live, you could have bad flower and make good live product. If you're freezing it week 7, week 6, you're capturing those heads at the right time, you could do it. You're not going to be able to scale it, but let me give you guys a taste of what we can do. And that's what we did. We made some live pens, live and a few hash pens, put them out in the market. We dropped our first one. It was called the Happy Camper. At that time, they didn't want to name them strain specific. It was all around camp and these cool day tripper and just things that, you know, canoe and stuff that I really was against because I'm a traditionalist. But these guys knew big retail marketing. They said, hey, this is going to be big. Let's do it. Trust us, Aaron. It'll work. And the pen worked. People loved it. When you tasted that flavor and you compared that to a distillate cartridge or a distillate disposable, stuff they were buying on the black market or even the dispensary at the time, the flavor was not comparable. You smoked a camp product, you knew this was what you needed to be consuming. This was the real deal. And that from there, it exploded. But it wasn't until the High Times competition that we really took off, because I went against what the marketing team wanted me to do at the time. And that was naming it the Happy Camper and all this really fun stuff. And I named them strain specific, what the cultivar was, what it was breeded to be. And that first one was Animal Face by Seed Junkie. And she was our baby. We loved her. She was great in the flower form, but in extract, she was something special. And we entered her into High Times as Animal Face. Animal Face, Solventless. And I'll never forget that day, because we were the small dog playing in the big pond with the guys from Moxie, playing with the guys from Tsunami in Vegas, who at that time had cornered the market in live resin cartridges. Shout out to both those guys, because they were producing a really quality pen that I believe was top tier. You know, it goes live resin, then distillate. There was no Solventless in Nevada. We came in there. They announced those two guys as the third and second place. I'm like, God, who got first? And it was us. It was Camp with our Solventless pen. That day changed everything for our brand, for myself, and for the guys, because we showed them that there was something different. There's an alternative to live resin and BHO. There's an alternative to trim and distillate. There's this thing called Solventless. Rest in peace, Frenchie Cannoli. We got that hash and we can put it into something that someone can consume on the go. We're no longer putting it on a knife over a stove and doing those knife hits. You know, we're no longer taking that brick of hash and consuming it in a pipe or a bong. We can put it into a pen, and a soccer mom can go pick this up at the store, smoke this thing, and then go get groceries or go hang with their kids and really smoke hashish. That was it, right? That unlocked everything for us, Nick.
Well, I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head with, you know, talking about the progression of, you know, the consumption. I mean, there are people who are alive today who consume cannabis that do not know what a knife it is. you know, you know, hot knives on a stove, you know, and one thing that, you know, is very interesting is you talked about you and your willingness to start at the ground level in a place that, you know, you're really C-suite. And I think that there's a lot of people who are very interested in getting into cannabis who do have a lot of talent, who simply aren't willing to start at the ground floor and work their way in that way. A lot of people are just tossing resumes out. And I think that that's a really special way to get that word out there that, hey, if you want to get into this industry and you really have a lot of belief behind the product, you have a lot of belief behind the plant, and you believe that you have something that you can bring to the industry, get in any way that you can. Start from the ground floor. Give a brand a reason to give you that chance. And I think that that's absolutely phenomenal that you guys are doing that. Now, when you first had that conversation with, you know, the camp guys and you were willing to take that path, I mean, was there any point in that process where you were deciding which brand to go with? And if so, like, what was the thing that really made you, you know, really tied and really enthusiastic about making camp the best it can be? Because obviously, you know, you're right. You know, the old school days of, you know, trying to enter into competitions. I remember Tim Blake, you know, shout out to the Emerald Club, the Emerald Cup. Like, I still remember Tim Blake saying during the Area 101 days, people would wear baklavas and stuff like that and masks because they didn't want anybody who knew who they were.
That's right.
So when you're first coming out into the scene, you know, how do you decide personally that camp is like, these are the people that align not just with what I want to accomplish career wise, but they align with what I want to accomplish from a morality standpoint and what I believe that I can bring to the industry.
That's great. Right. Like, it ties into what you said. You got to have some eat your humble pie. We all know a little bit. Some of us know a lot. Some of us know more than others, but everybody thinks they've got the latest, greatest, best idea. It's not easy to build a brand. It's super difficult in every market, in every, not just cannabis, everything. You know, branding is difficult. And I've had a few brands that have flopped, that haven't done anything. And it was this weird thing, right, Nick, where I had something super special that I knew nobody had in Nevada, and people called me niche. People called it boutique-y. And when I heard that, I'm like, all right, this is super special. Nobody understands it in Nevada. These guys are big corporate guys. They don't understand the game. They don't know that, you know, look to the underground to see what's popular, because those guys got it first. And I was part of that underground. And that right there, that culture, that connection, if a company respects that, understands it, you're not always going to meet eye to eye, because you got these guys, these big retail guys. Some of them are just, you know, college graduates, where most guys in my business aren't. They don't necessarily, it's kind of oil and water. And you've got to figure out how to operate within their, you know, their rules, their set of rules, and then our set of rules. And there's a little bit of finesse that had to go on, where I ate a little crow, they ate a little crow. I didn't necessarily agree. They didn't necessarily agree. We agreed to disagree. And you've got to play that game in order to get what you want sometimes. And what I wanted was Solventless to become mainstream in Nevada. And nobody is going to believe that in 2015, 2016. Distillate was king. I mean, people were mixing in Colorado. They were mixing like MCT oil and stuff with their pens to become profitable. So like the hardware wasn't even there to support Solventless at the time. And you've got to be able to have that vision, be relentless with your vision. Obviously, there's a lot of luck involved too, right, Nick? You got to find the right people. I mean, my story is a little bit of luck, skill, luck, right place, right time, where this company just had a brand. They didn't know what to associate with that brand. They didn't know what to put there. It was just a brand on paper with all the marketing behind it, but not a solid product. And I came in with, hey, I got something cool. And there was a guy on that team who said, oh, I love it. I love this pitch. This is great. How do we scale? And I was like, dude, you can't scale right away. There's no way. We've got to kind of ease ourselves in. And there was a lot of arguing in those first 2 years of scale us up 10,000 units a month. We got to go. We got to go. We got to meet demand. And I'm like, you can't do it, dude. We'll figure it out over time, but I can't do that with one little washing machine and one little freeze dryer. There's a process. And remember, a lot of that equipment didn't even exist in those days either to scale hashish. Especially in Vegas. So, you know, to answer your question, really it's finesse, and you've got to compromise on things that you're not so close to, and some things you've got to hold tight and not compromise on. And you got to be the type of person that figures out where you're going to eat that crow and where you're going to see that return in the future. And you got to play a little chess. And playing that chess leads you to success sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, they definitely put their trust in the right hands. I mean, your apps, like I said, you know, I toured your facility, both of your facilities here in Clark County. Absolutely phenomenal what you guys have going on, and especially considering the fact that most people in the cannabis industry are hyper-specialized. You're more of a jack of all trades, having been somebody who's a grower, somebody who's a hash maker, again, especially on the high-end artistry hash, such as rosin, and, you know, somebody who also has an administrative background, somebody who can actually build a team and get that team to operate correctly. One of the things that you know, obviously, as a grower, is time with the plant. You know, growing takes time. You have to, you know, figure out which strains are going to work for you, especially in terms of resin production for, you know, making hash. When you guys are trying to figure out your strain diversity, and you know you're working with the owners at the source, and you're working with you know, the people in your team trying to figure out, hey, you know, we got these strains in R&D. I think this one's going to come up to fruition soon. I think that this is going to be the next thing that the consumers are going to want. Between you and your team, kind of how do you keep ahead of the game in terms of deciding which strains that you guys are going to release in order to meet, you know, what's consistently an evolving consumer demand?
Yeah, so obviously, and I've been saying this for years, if you want to be ahead of the game, you want to be at the forefront, you've got to be breeding. You've got to be creating specialized strains for your brands that you're creating yourself. You can't just go find seeds, pop those seeds, do pheno hunts, do that stuff, because, you know, what's the difference between your brand and somebody else's brand? Everybody's got that strain. Everybody's got an LA Kush Cake. Everybody's got a first class funk. And, you know, breeding isn't something that you can decide on today and see the fruition of it in 4 months. It's years and years and years of work. So over at camp, what we do, it's obviously we've got breeding projects going on constantly. We've been doing this for about a year and a half now. So we're not even close to being where we want to be. We should have started the breeding projects 4 years ago, but again, finesse, right, Nick? You've got to, there's sometimes you're not going to get what you want right away, but eventually if you're persistent and you've got a plan, you can get it. So about a year and a half ago, they allowed us to start breeding and creating our own genetics that we are obviously breeding with a lot of research involved behind it. We know which cultivars historically yield the most. Sometimes we don't, and we stumble upon a really cool pheno like Cookies and Cream, who she doesn't have any GMO. There's no garlic in that thing, and she can yield a 7 or 8%. What are you talking about? Like 4 or 5% is your standard on live, and it's hard to find those strains. So we've got to be super meticulous about what we're breeding, what cultivars we're bringing in for just hash, and then how you're planting those in your rooms. We have two facilities, so we plant full rooms out for hash. And it's, you know, in the early stages, it was like, let's just see if this works. This is what somebody said worked. Let's try it. That's a nightmare. Doesn't work that way. You've got to be really planned out. So we started doing hash tests at all weeks, even week one, where you don't see any trichome production. We're just hash testing stuff. We're hash testing nugs typically week 6, 7, 8 is when we're going into the grow. We're pulling our colas down, typically the top ones. And then we're doing rudimentary jar tests, ice in jar, cold water, shake it up, see how much resin falls to the bottom. You do that enough, you know, we're doing this hundreds of times over a 2-3 week period. You kind of know which ones are going to give you 5-6% just based off of look. Because in Nevada, I can't really go test that jar. I can't make hash right away. I've got to test flower before it even makes it to the production facility. So you've got to figure out a way to sort of eyeball it. And it's not really scientific, but it works. Today it works. And we've got to operate within the constraints of the metric system here in Nevada, the CCB, who's the compliance board that oversees all movement in Nevada. So you got to figure out how to operate within that, because we want to operate compliantly and legally. Because luckily we have cannabis here in the state of Nevada, and we agreed to do what they've asked us to do in order to have it, instead of us growing at home and somehow getting into a Carl's Jr. parking lot and handing off a bag. You know, we have safe consumption here. We have safe purchasing going on in our dispensaries, safe growing, lab testing. That's what you want. We asked for it. We've got it. We need to operate within those constraints. So, you know, in order to create hash strains, you've got to grow for hash. If you want to be big and you want to do it big, or you want to do it right, most importantly, you've got to grow for hash. You can't just hash failed stuff. That don't work. You can't hash trim. That doesn't work. And you definitely just can't hash whatever's coming down. It's not profitable for your business. And those big guys that are allowing you to do this in their facilities, they're not going to let you do it very long if you're seeing 1-2% returns off your flower. So you've got to be well thought out and planned. You've got to know your hash. You got to know your plant.
I think the age-old adage, trash in, trash out, definitely applies there. If you're using subpar product to start with, you're going to get subpar product down the line. One thing I do want to ask you about, since you have such an intimate knowledge of the plant, is, you know, the biggest neighbor to the Silver State, obviously, California, largest adult use market in North America, other than, I should say, adult use retail market, considering that Mexico now has it legalized. When you're looking at California's growing market, and you had mentioned Seed Junkie, obviously, shout out to them, amazing genetics. Something that the California market's definitely been dealing with the last couple of years has been hop latent viroid. When I believe it's what, 90% of grows are now affected with it in California.
Yeah.
When you're looking at protecting genetics in Nevada and you're looking at protecting grows in Nevada, what are some things that you guys do as far as your SOPs are concerned to make sure that these types of plant diseases don't make it into our market? Because obviously, you know, you guys have one of the cleanest facilities that I've walked through in Clark County, and it's just heartbreaking to see what's going on in California. And so I'm curious to see, you know, what you guys are doing to prevent that possibility from reaching the Silver State.
Yeah, hop Latin is super scary, right? I heard about it about a year and a half ago, you know, going out to like the Emerald Cup and going out to some of those competitions. Still, you hear about it, you see it. I mean, you smoke the weed, you taste, you don't taste it, but you know that like it's not hitting as hard as it used to, and your OGs aren't OGs. Where's the OGs in California anymore? And It's just scary what that disease is doing to our world, you know, to the cannabis business, and not just the business, just the plant and the love that we have for this plant, knowing that there's a disease like this that's crippling grows, crippling my fellow cultivators. It's brutal. So we've got ahead of it about a year ago. We do not bring in clones into our building. We do not bring in any clones from California. I had already mentioned to you that we're doing in-house breeding projects. Those are coming from genetics that do not come from California. Obviously, it's all Vegas stuff. But in Nevada, because I spoke a little bit about the lab testing, they're able to do that testing for us in seed and clone form. So before we even bring any genetics through our grow or into our big rooms, we're doing hop Latin testing. And you don't test the top of the plant. You don't test the bottom of the plant. You test all different parts of the plant because it could be isolated to a leaf. It could be isolated to the base. You've got to do 4 tests on one, let's say, clone, or you can do 8 tests on 2 clones or 12 tests, however you want to do it. You can't do enough tests to be safe when you want to bring in some sort of cultivar into your facility. So we're doing a lot of testing before genetics are brought into our big rooms in Nevada. That's number one. Obviously, strict SOPs on our tools, strict SOPs on people going in and out of rooms, what rooms they're in, what cultivars they're working on. We try to keep a team on one cultivar a day, so that way, you know, we don't know enough about this virus yet. Maybe it's transferred in other ways that we don't know of. So we try to make sure we're isolating the cultivars that we're working on, so that if one does have it, which, by the way, Camp doesn't, we've got all our genetics tested in the state of Nevada, and none of them have it. We want to make sure that we're not transferring it from one to another to another. That would cripple a business like ours. It would cripple most businesses in Nevada. So you hope that people would go through the same precautions we are. I don't know how people get their genetics. I know how we get ours. And I refuse to go buy clones from anywhere. It's actually illegal in this state. So we don't do it. We stay away from it. And whatever goes into our big rooms, we make sure it's tested. We're doing specific testing on it. And that hopefully is going to prevent it from getting into our buildings.
Well, indefinitely, transferring clones definitely across state lines is illegal. I meant more along the lines of seed transfers because, yeah, it's absolutely scary. I mean, not knowing kind of, you know, how it's being transmitted beyond just the standard, you know, transmission of here's pollen from the plant or whatever, transmitting from plant to plant as you cross grow rooms. But absolutely scary for California's landscape, considering that 90% of the grows are currently infected. Being that you had originally done competitions in California, do you feel like this is, you know, the hop latent is something that can be eventually mitigated in the California market, eliminated possibly? Or is this something that's just going to be endemic to the market that operators are just going to have to be aware of and vigilant against?
Yeah, I mean, you can get rid of anything, right? But you've got to be willing to eat a lot of crow. At one time, we had powdery mildew in one of our facilities, and everybody was super scared. Don't lose our moms. We don't want to lose our legacy strains. And you know what? You heard all the different things about what powdery mildew was and how it got transferred. And, you know, is it inherently in your genetic? Is it being transferred through the air? And I just said, kill it all. You know, kill it all. We're going to have to take a huge loss for 4 months. We're going to start from scratch. We're going to lose our legacies. We're going to put good genetics in these buildings that don't have any disease. And that sometimes you've got to do that in order to save the next few years of your operation. And, you know, if you've got hop latent in California or even in Nevada, because I've heard about it out here, unfortunately, you're going to have to let go of some of those strains that you're super tied to and start over. And you've got to be very smart and meticulous about the beans that you pop, making sure that you pull those, get those beans up, rooted, get them into clone form, get those clones tested before you bring them into your big rooms. You've got to go, you're gonna have to spend a little bit of money to make sure that your rest of your investment is protected. And I think California, any state that's experiencing issues, not just hop latent, any type of issue that's systemically killing their grow, they've got to be smart and test this stuff at different stages before they introduce it into their, into their plan. And that's the only thing that's going to get rid of it, is they've got to be willing to take the L on the current grow, get rid of it. Me saying that, there's probably people cringing right now going, I've got millions invested in this. What are you saying? Yeah, I agree with you. It hurts. It's hurting me just to say it. But we went through it with powdery mildew, and the only way to get through it was to reset. And, it sucks to say that, but that's what you got to do when you've got something like that plaguing your business. You just can't keep going year after year after year. It's never going to get better.
Well, one thing, obviously Camp is crushing it here in Nevada. A lot of North America has definitely been coming on the line the last couple of years. Something that's been curious to me, and I'd love to get your take on it, is Europe in general. So we've seen kind of like a almost a lagging behind in Holland, whereas Holland used to be kind of the front runner for cannabis, both on the genetics, on the tech side. Now they're a little bit falling behind. We've seen Spain kind of pop up. How in tune, aside from just the source and Camp, but how in tune are Nevada brands as to what's going on, say, in Europe? And in your opinion, kind of how in tune are European brands to what's going on in North America?
So we've got some great guys in Nevada, probably everywhere, that are in tune with what's going on. If you're into cannabis, like you really love hash the way that I love hash, the way that a lot of people do, you've got to be looking outside and seeing what's happening. I just went to Spanibus again this past year, and you see a lot of strains like Skittles and some stuff that we had in California 4 or 5 years ago. And those guys are now bringing those genetics into their grows in Europe. But what I thought was interesting was they really don't focus on terpenes, test results. They talk about it. But when you ask to see those results, and especially when you're looking at genetics and asking, hey, what is this yield? Oh, 6-7%. Can I see a COA? What is that? You know, so they're definitely behind us there. We are more regulated out here, which is good and bad. Being regulated comes with its perks, because the one perk that I enjoy is the lab testing, because we can really find out what that cultivar is producing in terms of terpenes, cannabinoids, resin yield. I love that part about it. And in Europe, the places that I visited, you know, I've been to Spain, I've been to Amsterdam, I'm part of the culture in both of those places. There's not a lot of testing going on. I hope they get a hold of some of this cool equipment we've got out here, like Light Lab, and they're able to test some of those genetics and understand their cultivars a little better. But, you know, the past 2 years I've been out there, it's all about hash, man. And they've always been about hash, but it's really about hash and rosins and your washers. And I love that. I love to see that phenomenon taking on out there. I'd love to see more unique genetics to that region, because it's fun to go out there and see hazes. You don't see a lot of hazes out here, and just like real true hazes. I go to Europe to smoke hazes. I don't smoke hazes in Nevada or California or anywhere in the United States. You go to Amsterdam to smoke hazes. You go to Spain to smoke hazes. They got the best hazes out there. You know, you got Mila out there. You got the hash queen out there. And it's like, there's people out there that do things different than we do out here. And like, but we all love the same stuff, right? We all love hash. We all love good weed. And they're taking a lot of that from us, and we're taking some of that from them. And we're sharing, like in the Ego Clash, we're sharing good, we're sharing knowledge about good cultivars and what they can do for your scaled up grow. And I also love that they care about the home grows, and they still care about that, that small batch quality stuff. Guess what, guys? That's great. That's hash to me. That's, yes, we're scaling here in Nevada. Yes, Camp is a big brand, and there's a lot of solventless brands in Nevada coming online, but we all started in our homes. We all started in a closet somewhere, and that's when it was really fun, and we did really crazy stuff, innovative things that we didn't think were innovative. We were just stoners doing what stoners do, smoking some hashish and creating some really cool shit. And by doing that, we've created this revolution, and I didn't create it. There's guys that have been doing it fucking hundreds of years before me. I am not the innovator here. I am the innovator in my space. But there's guys that have been doing this that are locked up for doing what I'm doing today. And we've got to remember them, because those guys paved the way for me to do what I'm doing. And for anybody in Nevada and California that's doing it at scale, they paved the way for us. Yeah, so I know I got off on a little tangent, but.
No. And shout out to Mila Jensen and the Pollinator crew over in Amsterdam. Obviously, you know, the originators of commercializing hash. Just fantastic. And I believe that she took, the Person of the Year award or Lifetime Achievement award over at the Emerald Cup this year. So again, really, really appreciate Mila, you know, obviously rest in peace, Frenchie Cannoli, shout out to Cammy Cannoli, you know, the people who definitely have been doing the hash for a long time, but you know, kind of when you're seeing the evolution of hash, not just in North America, but seeing in the European markets, I mean, Amsterdam is still, due to regulation, still really stuck on, you know, their isolator bubble bag, really starting to get on the rosin side. Do you believe that eventually rosin will kind of push all other forms of hash out of the market? I mean, because I mean, I don't really see a lot of bubble hash being sold anymore.
Right? Yeah, I hope not, right? I hope not, because the best form of consumption in my world is hashish. It's a nice brick hash that I can pull apart and smell. I can put it in a saran wrap and bury it in my backyard for 30 days. You know, pull it out and you got that smell. Like, I can't, it's hard to describe that smell unless you're a hash maker and you know that type of hash, but like, I hope not. I hope that that becomes mainstream, because rosin's just easy. You know, rosin's easy for the guy growing in his garage back in the day. What, we used to have a hair straightener, and then my buddy who was a pretty hefty dude, I would jump on his back and he would step on the press, the hair straightener, and out came the rosin. Like, if you can do that, why not? Hash is an art form. Making hash is not easy. And in order to scale hash, it's pretty difficult. And especially with testing out here in Nevada, people can't seem to get the yeast and mold out of the hash. It's not an unsafe amount of yeast and mold, but you know, Nevada's testing regulations are super strict. So I would imagine that in similar states that have regulations like ours, it's difficult to bring Temple Ball, that nice cured hash resin, to the market, and rosin's so much easier. So, you know, I hope that rosin doesn't take over the traditional hashish, but it's definitely easier to scale and more people are able to get into the market doing that. But I'll tell you, Nick, rosin is enabled. Just bringing rosin, not resin or live resin, but rosin out there, it's made more people aware of hash, because rosin is great. Flower rosin is fun. It's cool. It's easy. It's great. Hash rosin is really, really good. Live rosin is even better. There's levels to this stuff, and it's made people aware, because I've sat in circles where people argue, oh, live rosin is the best. And I'll say, have you smoked hashish? Have you experienced that before? And then they go, no, I've never tried that. Well, try it. It'll blow your mind. It's just, you know, by function of how easy it is to manufacture a flower rosin for anybody who's growing and smashing nugs, it's just become the most popular way to consume.
Well, and looking at regulation here in the Nevada markets, when you're taking into consideration, you know, everything that you guys have to deal with, everything that, say, California regulators are instituting, obviously the Silver State more than doubled possession limits recently. Do you feel like regulators are starting to figure it out in Nevada and in California? Or, I mean, California obviously has its own issues, but do you feel like regulators are starting to figure this out by working with some of the operators? Or do you think it would take something like an actual operator or somebody who was a previous executive at a plant touching brand to become a regulator for them to finally, you know, get this, you know, through their head that certain things simply don't make sense for the industry?
Yeah, that would definitely help them get there faster. And you got to have a guy will like myself or anybody that's been in it as long as I have to get in there with them and show them. Fortunately, at camp, or unfortunately, depending on how you're going to look at it, we've paved the way with the CCB more times than not on things that nobody has seen out here. Solventless was one of them. Ice cream. Shout out to the chefs Ricky and Becky. Like, they've never seen that out here, and those two have been able to create a cannabis infused hash ice cream that the CCB had no idea how do we test that? How do we regulate that? How do we measure dosage? And we work with them. We work with them every day on getting those things passed. And those two, Ricky and Becky, they were able to get ice cream passed in the state of Nevada. And it was a very, very meticulous process for them. And we did that same thing with Solventless. We did it with hash infused pre-rolls. You know, there's a breadth of products that we've manufactured over the past 4 or 5 years that we're never here in this market. Some have failed. THCA diamonds, rosin diamonds in 2016. Like, they didn't know what the heck that stuff was. There wasn't a category in Confident Cannabis. I couldn't submit to the CCB, and at that time it was the Department of Taxation, and say, hey, we want to make this. And they'd say, well, what is that? You know, we know distillate, we know shatter or butters, but what the heck is a rosin diamond, you know? And there's got to be guys pushing that envelope. You can't get frustrated. You've got to work with the regulators, get them to understand we're not doing anything illegal. We're not doing anything shady. We're trying to create really cool, innovative products. We want to make it easier for the consumers in Nevada to be able to purchase a product, be safe with what they're consuming. And we're going to have to be the guinea pigs. And camp more times than not has been that person or that brand to kind of break those barriers. And you've got to be willing to do that. Costs a lot of money sometimes, a lot of time. Innovation isn't easy, but you've got to be willing to do it. And getting them to understand hand in hand that this is a safe product, let me show you how we can dose it correctly, that's the way you become successful in states that don't understand innovation or don't have the regulation on newer products. Work together with your regulators.
Well, and it's cool that the regulators actually are working with you on that type of innovation, such as, you know, the ice cream. Whereas, you know, I've heard more times often than not, you know, the BCC or now DCC in California refuses to help, you know, certain brands try to figure out what this regulation exactly means because they're afraid of setting a precedent which could then be exploited. So that's great that they're actually working with you on that. When you're looking at, you know, innovation and new products on the scene, such as ice cream, obviously I'm assuming that part of that draw is, social use, which is, you know, now we have, I believe it's three, licensed, consumption lounges just got their licenses here in Clark County. There's supposed to be a lot more coming down the pipeline. When you're looking at social consumption and you're looking at, say, new products and innovations that you guys want to bring to the market, how much consideration is given into social consumption versus, say, personal use at home consumption?
A lot, you know, especially given the regulations and understanding, you know, the small doses and the bulk that we have to send over to these places. It's great because, you know, for our bottom line, if you can imagine, I mean, you saw our facility, it takes a lot to package up a pen or it takes a lot to package up some gummies. you know, we're going to cut a lot of that out by shipping bulk to these lounges, and allowing them to distribute it and portion it out, and which I love. I think this, it's an amazing thing. I think Nuwoo is doing a great thing over there at their facility with their little consumption lounge that they've had for a few years now, and then their big expansion that they're doing. I mean, stuff like that is awesome, right? We are in Las Vegas, we are the entertainment capital of the world, and you want to bring people out here to smoke, just like when I used to go to Amsterdam to smoke in 2008. Nobody was doing it out, you know, nobody's doing that out here. And I wanted to be a part of that. That was fun. That was edgy. That was, you know, to go out there and be able to smoke a joint on the street and go check out some art or go check out a really cool museum. That was cool. And Nevada needed to make that happen out here because there's a lot of cool things to do for adults, and being able to do it on weed, man, is really cool. now, so we do like to make products specifically for the future with these lounges.
Now I do got to ask, because, you know, you're somebody that has been to Amsterdam. I know that West Hollywood in Southern California really wanted to create an Amsterdam-esque atmosphere. In my opinion, like, don't get me wrong, I love the woods. I love smoking there. I love the Artistry. Artistry probably has one of the best, you know, consumption lounges for the average consumer in Southern California. But when you're looking at, you know, kind of the Amsterdam model of people just being able to walk in off the street with whatever they have on them, do you think that will ever become a reality in Las Vegas? Or, you know, how do you, because I know that you guys currently aren't doing a consumption lounge, I don't think currently, or at least you guys aren't going for a license yet. But when you're taking a look at what consumption or social use could be, taking that Amsterdam model, do you think that that's possible in the United States?
I hope so. I hope so. I hope so. Right? Like, come on, man. Like, cannabis doesn't kill people. Cannabis is, it's love, man. Like this stuff, like I told you in the beginning, I'm creating products to help ailments, to help people. And we know that the passing a joint to your buddy isn't going to cause him to go out and do something crazy and hurt somebody. And you would hope. Now, you know, my daughter plays soccer. I'm a soccer dad, and there's a lot of those dads that are police officers. And, you know, those guys look at me like I'm absolutely insane. So hearing them and what their perspective of, there's a huge disconnect between what I think is good and great for our city and what those guys believe is good and great for our city. And, you know, they're very concerned with people smoking and the smell and the weed and secondhand smoke. And I think there's more of those guys and saying that than there's of me saying, hey man, spread the love. Let's go. It's not going to hurt people. We're not involving children. There's adults out on the strip at 2 a.m. But, you know, you've got a lot of that. And I didn't understand that perspective until I started listening to these guys. I would never speak to a police officer before my daughter played soccer. And, you know, just by, you know, they're in my area at this point, we're having these really constructive conversations. And it's interesting to hear why they don't like what we're doing and what I'm doing and my business. I'm getting them to understand it. But there's a lot of those people, Nick. So I think it's going to be difficult. Keeping them into the lounges, that's a big win. The Source does have a lounge. We want a license, but we haven't done anything with it. But I think this is the first step, just like with Solventless, what I said, you've got to kind of give and take a little bit in order to maybe get what we want in the future. Do I necessarily want people walking up and down smoking weed in the street? I don't know, but should somebody be ostracized for it or even being given the ability to make that decision for themselves? Absolutely. Well, so we'll see what happens as time goes on.
Well, I was going to say, the one thing that concerned me, especially as Southern California first opened up, was, you know, the whole idea of a corkage fee. Because I had been somebody who, you know, like you, I've been going to Amsterdam for, I think, 10 years now. Every single year I try to go out there for New Year's. And like, I don't know if they could institute a corkage fee at over there versus, you know, here in Southern California. You know, $35 per person was kind of the average as a corkage fee when OG Cannabis Cafe opened up. Do you think that they might find a happy middle ground where maybe, you know, you can't bring obviously your flower off the street, but maybe the corkage fee isn't as high? Like, what do you feel like the future of social consumption will look like?
Yeah, maybe down the road, right? I know, and just like when Nevada became medical and then into rec, the laws were pretty strict. You know, everything was very strict. You confined to this very, very fine-tuned set of regulations, and then you've seen them expand, like you just said, where they're opening up the limits, and we're slowly getting a little more as they understand, hey, maybe those regulations don't actually work that way that we intended them to. We've got to open up a little bit. We've got to allow a little bit more. And you're going to get that love if you've got people advocating and then just showing them why. You've got to show them why. I mean, you can't just say you've got to because this is right. No, show them why it's right. You know, why it makes sense for somebody to come in and bring in their weed that they bought from another dispensary into this lounge and not necessarily buy it in the lounge or there's reasons why we should, and there's reasons why we shouldn't. And we've got to be able to show in our state, the CCB, why it's okay and why there's not risk, or you're not going to put a child at risk, or you're not going to, I don't know, whatever they think is going to screw it all up. That's some weird perception that you have that you don't have any data to back up, and you can't fight them with fire. You've got to give them some cookies. You know, maybe they've got some weed in them, but you know, you've got to do that type of thing.
That would certainly shift things if we decide to take over. I believe in Canada. I think Canada is really the only place right now that allows their law enforcement officers to consume after hours. I think that would absolutely change a lot of opinions real rapidly. I know I don't have you for too much longer. Again, I really appreciate the time that you've given. What's coming down the pipeline next for you guys? I know that you guys are releasing new hardware. I believe it's a proprietary design that you guys helped create. What's coming up next for both the Source and Camp?
Yeah. So the biggest thing we got going on right now, my pride and joy, other than cultivation, passing a ridiculous amount of high testing weed, which has been amazing. A lot of love to Frank, Irene, and Luis over there at our cultivation facilities. But the big thing that we're combating is, with rosin is a huge success for us. Solventless has been big in the pen. The hardware didn't match the experience. Initially, in the beginning stages of our solventless, the pens were great. Everybody loved them. We didn't have any defect rates. Everything was beautiful. And then our factory in Shenzhen changed. We didn't change it. It just changed without us knowing. And we started to see the defect rate in our pens increase over and over. And it was because we were using a wick technology, just like most companies are using with their 510 threaded cartridges. And that wick is super counterproductive to smoking good hash and rosin. So luckily, over time, technology has evolved. And I created this really, really cool, innovative disposable. It's a push button, variable voltage disposable, which you do not have in Nevada. Nobody's putting rosin in a variable voltage disposable because at that time, it was extremely expensive to do that. And nobody had the technology, and the technology now caught up. And I Frankensteined one together. I worked with an amazing group that helped me create this pen over a 6-month period that solved all of our issues. It's a ceramic bucket that doesn't have any wick inside of it. It's got dual path airflow on the left and the right. So you're not sucking through the oil like most disposables are designed to do. It's kind of pulling it in from the outside. It's a variable voltage, similar to like a Puffco or an Evo or any of those cool on-the-go dab technology that people are utilizing today. And now if you do experience some sort of clog, which I haven't done yet on my lowest settings, our proprietary low settings, you can jack that boy up to red and pull through it, which combats the issues that the team... What we were experiencing, Nick, was I didn't know that people were passing disposables. That's like in a different world. You pass a joint, you pass you'll even pass your bong or your pipe, but pass a disposable, what? And they'd pass it and it'd heat and they'd pass it. Or you do these things, these blinkers that the kids are doing nowadays, where they're taking these huge rips and you start blinking your disposable and that's frying out your battery. So that coupled with the thick rosin, because we don't use solvents to pull out the lipid, rosin is rosin, hash is hash. That goes into the disposable or the cartridge. People were just burning them out. So you're not able to do that with this. It's got a recharging port at the bottom, which you'll never have to use, but it's there for you to be comfortable with. It's flat bottom, so you can stand it up. It's got USB-C on the side, So it's, you know, we're keeping up with the latest technology. This disposable really complements the flavor inside of our solventless. And that's all that I've been aiming to do for the past 4 years is get the technology to the point where you can really taste the flavor. Now you'll never go back to a distillate vape. You may not hit a live resin vape either if you smoke a really good hash, live rosin, or flower rosin pen. So the big thing that Camp's got going on right now is we're about to launch our new disposable. Nobody in Nevada will have something like this. I suspect it'll be at least 6 months before somebody rips us off. But again, like most things we do, we're the first to market. We're the best to do it. And we're going to be launching that on 7/10 along with our Puff Punch drinks. Our other brand, our subsidiary brand, is called High Heads, and we're releasing an innovative 100 milligram drink. And it's amazing. It's shaped like a flask, so it fits in your back pocket. Take it to concerts or take it on the drive with you if you want to go see the Dead or just something really cool.
We would like to thank Aaron for his time and being on today's episode. If you would like to find out more about Camp or The Source, please make sure to visit them online at www.thesourcenv.com. And that'll do it for us. As always, make sure to stay tuned to the next episode here on Conversations in Cannabis.